My name's Karen Giussone, and I'm the Helen Bernstein Librarian for Periodicals, and it's my real pleasure to welcome you all here tonight to the New York Public Library for Periodically Speaking. We are marking 5 years this spring, so kind of in honor of that, or to mark that, we're sort of changing our format. We're going to have a reading and a discussion. But having said that, you know, the ideas, the themes of what we started with 5 years ago are the same, you know, which is to provide a venue for emerging writers, to support independent literary publishing, and to highlight the literary magazine collection here at the library. So I encourage you to come back and check it out, and also check out our website. Follow us on Facebook and all that good stuff. A big thanks to CLMP, particularly Tasha, where she, for this wonderful program tonight. Thank you very much. And look for the podcast that will be available on the NYPL website shortly. And now, without further ado, I'm going to introduce the executive director of CLMP, who will introduce the program. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, Karen. Let me say a quick word about CLMP, the Council of Literary Magazines and Presses, for those of you who may not know us. We were founded in 1967 to help small publishers through the business of publishing. So we help independent literary publishers, literary magazines, and small presses with all of the unsexy things that make reading great literature possible, marketing, fundraising, etc. And we're thrilled to do this program with the New York Public Library, celebrating some of our very favorite literary magazines. Tonight we'll be celebrating a public space, in particular its poetry. And as Karen said, on our fifth year, we are trying a new format. We'll have some brief readings followed by a discussion. And to lead that discussion and to introduce our poet readers tonight, Brett Fletcher Lauer, poetry editor of A Public Space, who himself is also a very fine poet, as well as the managing director of the Poetry Society of America. Brett Lauer.
I want to thank Jeffrey and Tasha and Karen for inviting A Public Space and for this beautiful space. A Public Space is an independent magazine of art and argument, fact and fiction. It was founded in 2005 by Bridget Hughes, who is here. The magazine is a forum for new ideas and new conversations, and each issue brings together a wide range of global voices to tell the stories of the 21st century. A Public Space publishes 4 issues a year, which amounts to over 60 poets a year. We've published such poets as Ann Carson, Adrienne Rich, Ben Lerner, Matthew Zapruder, and Carl Phillips, as well as the two poets who will be reading tonight. I couldn't be happier to be introducing Timothy Donnelly and Jennifer Cronovit, primarily because I think they're pretty much fantastic poets, one with a brand new book and the other with a second book forthcoming. But I should also disclose that I've known them both for about a third of my life. Timothy hired me at my current job, and I actually hired Jenny at one point, but she no longer works there. And so it was both this work, both their poetry and this personal history that I have with them that I thought would allow us to have a conversation off topic, whatever comes up. They'll each read for about 10 minutes. And then afterwards, we'll sit down to talk. So Timothy Donnelly is the author of 27 Props for a production of Eine Lebenszeit from Grove Press. Jory Graham wrote that his first book is a rare thing in poetry, a passionate meditation, a wild ride, fun read, and wrenching, sometimes even scary document regarding who we were and are. His second book, The Cloud Corporation, is forthcoming from Wave Books. He's been the poetry editor of Boston Review since 1996, and he teaches in the School of the Arts at Columbia University. Jennifer Cronovit's first book, A Wayward, was selected by Jean Valentine for publication by Boa Editions in 2009. Mary Jo Bang wrote that the poems in A Wayward send back brilliant bulletins about what is difficult to put into words. Jenny is the co-founder and co-editor of Circumference, a journal of poetry and translation. This fall, she'll be teaching in the creative writing program at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. Please welcome Jenny.
Thanks so much, Brett, and thanks to Karen and Jeffrey and everyone at CLMP. And thank you all for coming. I don't know if I can hold my book.
Can you guys hear me if I'm not using this? Okay.
So I'm going to read from A Wayward, which is written out of the experience of living in a foreign country and a foreign culture. And the first poem I'm going to read is called Weekend. We left the main street for the alley. Smoke rose from the meat and it rose from the mouths of men. Here, the men and the women talk through smoke, and the men talk to each other through smoke, and the women hold hands while they talk. We left a country for this country, where I don't make decisions about what I see. I don't allow myself. In the alley, we slowly decide how to eat and what to say. Does everyone live in a landscape for a reason? On a mountain, there must be a reason. In a field, less. In a city, the reason is a tenant. You say the story is the reason. A river is a reason. We don't have one. An alley is a reason for eating and avoiding the oncoming car. You make conversation, and I undo it. I'm undoing it. The uniforms, huh? Waitress, nurse. Wheel as wheel, bull as bull. A kind of clean, the dirty kind. A line reaches from one person to another. Army-style staff beating, you could do better. Irony, irony stored in my stomach like toast. We pee squatting with our butts so close to the ground, us girls. I talk to another more than myself. The same words, anathema, bibliographic, mark our language as fallen. Stencils of trees to decorate trees. At the museum, you are impressed by ancient bronze. Metal ribs of another. I wield a dull knife to my way of seeing. The cloud thoughts, not muscles, feel the threat. The word hinges, like tools of unknown origin, exposed under the more modern way. To light old artifacts. My use of you could distill us, make room for another experiment in materials. I grew up in Manhattan, and something that's so wonderful about the New York Public Library is that there's so few places that you can feel nostalgic in, because the city's changing so much, I think. So the New York Public Library is definitely one of those places. And another one of those places for me is the Museum of Natural History, which hasn't ever changed. The exhibits rarely change. I guess they changed the whale recently. And it's one of the places where I feel very nostalgic and remember my childhood. And I recently took my son there, and I took him to see those dioramas, and he just started weaving at all of the dead animals, and I realized what like a very sinister museum of death, like a dead zoo it is. He was just so excited, and then they just weren't moving back. It was great. The Museum of Nature. The Earth's humus is made fertile through the worm's anus. Horseshoe crabs are experimented upon for their accessible optic nerve. I have wanted to be unmoved by the world. Take the eye apart, and you find we reverse things into what we can see. Distilled vein within the dead ox's face, your own face in the glass, unchanged by what you might be thinking. You could survive in a forest for years if there was a river and a chance of returning to your life, or that you would lay down by the bank and still stay until it was your season, and any thought of return a trick as useless as the urge to cup your hands around the reflection of sky and drink from it. The mountains are made into a road and the land has direction. On one side is the country, and on the other side is the country, its character residing in roofs. When I speak the road, I am spilling the water and dropping my plate. When I am in the city and use the language the city was built within, I am spilling myself into a lake, or they who know the language are twice what I want to say, and tall, not wet. When I arrived, I was worse at speaking, but speaking was either sky or dirt, and now the sky is a different shape, and the words not symbols, but layers of skin. Reinforced concrete. The way you see me was made palpable to me. There, boom. I said false cognate, which made me even more probable. I said that here the word for proprietor is old board, neither affectionate nor cruel. I ordered food so I could stop seeing myself, saying myself, but the proprietor misunderstood us as even more ridiculous than we usually are, so we let him decide everything. The dishes he served implied that our use of affection is always under evaluation. Luckily, you know to be public even when no one is watching. I'm going to read two more poems, and the second to last one is a prose poem also. Bedtime Story. They name it the Dream City because it hasn't been built. The park is designed to look like a park, the zoo a zoo. The museum started planning an exhibition of inkwells to celebrate the one-year anniversary of the museum before the museum was designed. This could be a fiction so wide they built a river to fill it, but it's not. The river was always there. We want the city to be the kind of city the little girl will feel nostalgic about when both happy and depressed. All her colors will be based on the colors of that city. And now the temporary is already seeming permanent, a good sign. There is a lake, and it is third biggest in the world if we say it is. There have been drownings, accidental, all caused by over-admiration. Lack of admiration can be equally dangerous. The police are already stationed in the most beautiful spots to make them a little less lovely and thereby protect us. I need protecting. I will move into any idea faster than onto a long-awaited city-to-city bus. You like this about me, but I find it a terrible quality in you. After seeing the exhibition of writings by old men in our city, you say, let's become old men. We shut the TV off and you say, let's argue. About what? About the dream city. And then we decide to put the little things off until the city is finished and we go. The shallow son of it. This week and the next, you live in a place and it doesn't know. You fear the three-wheeled taxi, a smell too close to the fruit stand. The accent is your lemon. There wasn't a way to mask myself as real. Instead, like an egg or a radish. Alert, pineapple longing, or contact with milk. I'm going by definition and I don't know how to say it. Just bye or bye-bye.
My name is Timothy Donnelly, and I'm going to read five poems. And I wanted to thank Brett Lauer and the staff of A Public Space, and also Jeffrey Leppendorf and the staff of the CLMP, and also the staff of the library. It's a real privilege to read here, especially to read here with Jenny. The first of the five poems I'll read actually draws from something that I'm nostalgic for, a childhood constant in my life, not the New York Public Library or the Museum of Natural History, but a volume of a series of childhood encyclopedias called Childcraft. I don't know if people are familiar with them. They had one volume that was my favorite. It was volume 13, and the last chapter in that particular volume was it proposed a number of pastimes that the sick kids could undertake, and that section was called Fun for the Shut-In, and I always thought it was a very sort of glamorous kind of position to find oneself in, sort of like stuck in bed as a kid. I felt people would bring things to you, and you could have a certain amount of prolonged alone time, and this book proposed that you could actually do make crafts while you were in that bed. And I call it Fun for the Shut-In. I do revisit the idea a bit darkly, though. Fun for the Shut-In.
Demonstrate to yourself a resistance to feeling unqualified despair by attempting something like perfect despair embellished with hand gestures. Redefine demonstration to include such movement as an eye's orbit around the room, the pull of red through drinking straws or the teeth of a comb, random winces, twitches, ticks, the winding of clocks and tearing of pages, the neck hair's response to uninvited sound, light, and the scent of oranges where none in fact exist. Admit to yourself you lost your absolute last goldfish, this one in a fashion that looked more or less like relaxing, at least as you have come to think of it. There is an aspect of blue seen only twice before, deep underwater and now. Take notice of the slow, practically imperceptible changes always underway around or inside you, like tooth decay, apostasy, the accumulation of dust, debt, the dead, and what the dead are preparing to say if offered a seat at the table. Place the cold paperweight toad-like on your forehead. Hold inhumanly still. Everyone comes close to growing their own avocado. Everyone has a mind to plant it where they want to. If you have power over breakfast, invest every burst back into yourself to double the power at half the cost. Messages from under the floorboards demand bed rest. That handful of dried beans stitched into the sanctity of twin paper plates makes the sound of never leaving even brighter than before. Try amplifying the playback from the rattle at hand to drown out any stubborn thoughts to the contrary, the collapse of a country, Steely Dan, and the thunder of 100 icebergs calving. Offer the dead a seat at the table. Now take it away. Just pull it out from under them. Hypnosis is like deep focus with a sleeper hold on self-critique. Attempt levitation as a measure of your apology. Let's put it this way. You don't want to be their bitch, but you don't want to piss them off much either. Ask them what they're having. Listen with patience to their long, elaborate talk. Soon, one of the dead will conduct an infinitely slow white envelope across the unlit tabletop, a human sigh through a wall of exhaust. The letter itself will be left unsigned, but you'd recognize that handwriting anywhere. The next poem is called The Rumored Existence of Other People. I dreamt my household consisted largely of objects manufactured by people I would never meet or know, and some of these objects dangled from the ceiling, while others towered dizzily upwards from the floor. If most of them stayed where I left them as if dozing in embryonic thought, still others came with features conducive to movement, making them appear more endearingly alive as they powered up and off in search of excitement, an hour's diversion, no harm in that. Intuition stopped short of determining whether or not any of the objects kept in contact with their makers via some kind of bond, perhaps a physical connection explicable through science, or else a spiritual affinity notoriously difficult for an outside party to understand. But the more I gave it thought, the more it seemed to me believable. A silver line, a souvenir, a sieve of relation, meaning to release something lovingly means always remaining tied to it. As to be somewhere completely means never having to leave. I thought to figure out how many presences collected around me at that moment. Did they possess consciousness? Would they cooperate? Should I expect a new kind or the mundane damages? Everywhere I might be now in light of where I've been. I dreamt I held out my hand and before long a banana flew up from the industrious parenthesis of Costa Rica and provided for that hand before it knew it wanted. Start slow, be consistent, and your levels will increase. I dreamt the will of manufacturers to produce goods was shed from those goods long after they were made. All the windows overlooking a landfill or production site. The more I gave it thought, the more it seemed to me obvious. Also touching. Whoever built that warehouse across the way built it thinking someone would one day look at it in wonder. Also sorrow. To keep an endless store of that feeling. To make, to provide it. That I might turn my back on a building like that will have become unthinkable tomorrow when my sympathy with most abandoned things is effectively cut from the budget. I dreamt it in increments of 3, 5, and eventually 10. Not the way the objects at hand rubbed me, but more the way those beyond me made me pang for them there. I might even say the walls, the floors, the plush carpets unrolled on the floors, and the furniture, the refrigerator and any item in it, nautical tchotchkes and the curtains clamped tight as August call hogs to optimize my output. The shedding of the will, too, takes place incrementally, across decades, late at night, the little shifting in a room's air profile comparable to a ghost's entrance, if not quite equivalent. At work behind the warehouse, everything else, droplets on navy felt, protection sensed in a system whose products had begun to forecast accurate wants. I dreamt of body's indentation beside me on the mattress, vanishing as the presence found the door through a film adaptation of silence, child with gifts for ravens in pockets, lady affianced to alien abduction, figure of the human experiment almost over. I opened my mouth and in no time, lasagna, Chianti, a greater than expected rate of melting, atrophy, military action, and a ravenousness that shook my confidence in the hinged box I keep pin money in. The rumble of it recalls the convulsion Plato says the gods sank Atlantis with to chasten its inhabitants, whose vast majority descended from Poseidon and one of the island's earthborn shepherdesses. As long as divinity remained predominant in their nature, Atlanteans kept obedient to the laws of their progenitor, but over time, what was divine diminished, and love of wisdom and virtue gave way to love of wealth and luxury, which in the past had seemed merely distractions. To those who lacked the ability to see through the radiance of things, the Atlanteans appeared to be thriving. Palaces, baths, mines rich in orichalcum, herds of elephants, vineyards, orchards, access to upwards of a dozen sherbets, the chance to astonish house guests with golden oblongs and lozenges, to watch as vampires turned mortals into vampires for cash, despite the fact that vampires could easily devise a life without having to dirty their pale hands with money again, but apparently nothing restores that old vitality like a night of spending. I dreamt a percentage of my money had been touched by entrepreneurs of the undead. I dreamt I'd never guess how much, dreamt no idea where my money had been, what bathroom floor or choir stall or alp or what disgrace, dreamt I couldn't taste a difference, dreamt my money might want company, and I had better not keep putting it in my mouth in that case. As drawing from a songbird's coloratura, I dreamt the secret to prosperity is being commonesque. Profiteroles, remote control, the ruin of my body, and tremulous as horses hidden in old plaster, confused as vinyl siding, certain as what's happening can't have all at once, or even all that fast, but by degrees imperceptible until too late, eyes trained to other tasks as the sheep took to clover, distracted as a vortex of plastic debris, measuring twice the size of Texas patched itself together mid-Pacific, a swirl like a god's intoxicated eye, but not surveillant, voyeuristic, a bright new continent only in it for the kicks, its culture to bask, its historiography accidental, with every bit of flotsam serving as a double record of one product's manufacture and consumption. I dreamt in complex packaging that posed no less a threat at the factory warehouse than up among my cupboards or dropped into the superabundant trash bins at airports. Found it simple and good to forget that threat by letting perception of such objects eclipse true knowledge of them. Any worry washed in umbra, like being in the moment only endlessly. I hear the naked hands of strangers make my dumplings, but experience insists what makes them mine is money. I open the door and I extend good money into ancient night, night prosperous with stars, order heavy in my hand. I'm immortal that way. I lie down and I feed. This next poem is one of two poems that was published in a public space a little while back, and it's called The Last Vibrations. Meanwhile, we wanted the sentence to continue, fading as we thought another would begin, only after the first had finished, and the last vibrations seemed not to extend from the sentence anymore, but the fact that we had heard it fading there together. The air off the river remembered our being someplace else, or a time behind us waiting to return. and the chill presented its case for returning, knowing what happened next must somehow depend on dismantling much of what happened before. Therefore, we tried to prolong the sentence to give ourselves time to decide by repeating it, time to decide. We knew that we couldn't determine what happened down to the detail, but felt we might determine how the mind should turn to meet it, the mind having often believed itself to be struggling to continue, or thought itself that struggle to begin with. In time to put that thinking aside, we thought yellow leaves had torn through the blue partitioned into day, but it was nowhere apparent that they had. Down a channel of houses framed in river air, we thought we could see a portion of the water, but what we took for water had foiled itself into a field of yellow light. We knew that we might go on like that forever without progression, because the thought of moving forward kept holding us back, the way the thought of keeping still made us want to throw ourselves like light on the river, unburdened of that thinking we imagined might extend endlessly thereafter, the way we thought we wanted it. Light, river, air. Through the time we made, we felt what happened dismantle into yellow leaves, thought prolonged into trembling sentences. Thought leaves houses. The last vibrations faded to be remembered in a place we would never finish imagining. And it was then we began. This next poem takes its title from a section of the Egyptian Book of the Dead, and it actually makes some references back to the first of the poems I read. It's called Chapter for Removing Foolish Speech from the Mouth. Tuning in again to the long, elaborate talk of the dead, ear held to a glass held to what's left of the world, I let them lullaby me back to where it all got underway. Sick day centered on a little bed, papered walls my sphere, birdsong's infinite punctures in air like ticker tape from the branches fine interweaving. I don't think to worry here whether half-truths and music serve to reveal truth or else only confuse it as stiff breezes prove emphatic with their first purple hyacinth and diesel. To what extent stating a truth implies an endorsement and when to embrace mere statement means calling it true. I name the bees, sun's diplomats to an embassy of flowers, whether neighbors want me to or not. Latest clouds and apricot coach my lips against wordless chance, through wordless chance against a purr fuming from the nearby textile factory. I'm not moving a muscle. Any exercise to the tune of work will have to wait for habit's stratocumulus to overcast this puny light and need to stuff my mouth with bargain cottons. When I'm done, I will be done. And the dead will come, riding their bone boomerang to return me to that vertical life, tentative at first, then all at once, as one might remove red bandages at night, hands dutifully maneuvering me forward as they take me to task for having squandered so much time on that sinkhole reverie I might have invested in real estate or futures. And the last I'll read, draws its final image from a section of Gibbon's History of the Rise and History of the Fall of the Roman Empire. Apparently, at one point, a Hun shepherd presented Attila with a sword that he found in a field, and Attila recognized it as the sword of Mars with which he would attempt to topple an empire. His future as Attila the Hun. But when I try to envision what it might be like to live, detached from the circuitry that suffers me to crave, what I know I'll never need, or what I need but have in abundance already, I feel the cloud of food court breakfast loosen its embrace. I feel the shopping center drop as its escalator tenders me up to the story intended for conference space. I feel my doubt diminish, my debt diminish. I feel a snow that falls on public statuary doesn't do so sadly because it does so without profit. I feel less toxic. I feel the thought my only prospect lies under a train for the coverage stop. Don't think I never thought that way because I have and do all through blank October, a dollar in my pocket back and forth to university. Let the record not show. I have deserted me for what I lack and am not worth. All of this unfolds through episodes that pale as fast as others gain from my inertia. I have watched, I'll keep watching, out from under blankets as the days trip over the days before, out cold on the gold linoleum behind them, where we make the others rich with sick persistence. But when I try to envision what it might be like to change, I see three doors in front of me, and by implication, opportunity. Rooms full of it, as the mind itself is full, thinking of a time before time was, or of the infinite couch from which none part. And while the first two doors have their appeal, it's the third I like best, the one behind which opens a meadow, vast, and in it, grazing on buttercups, an errant heifer with a wounded foot. Its bloody hoofprints followed by a curious shepherd back to something sharp in the grass, the point of a long sword which, unearthed, the shepherd now polishes with his rodent skin tunic, letting the Eurasian sun play upon it for effect, a gift for me, a task, an instrument to lay waste to the empire now placed before me at my feet. Thanks.
Check. Thank both of you for that. That was wonderful. How are you guys doing?
Pretty well. And you?
I'm doing okay. It's a long day. I do have James Lipton questions that I am going to ask at the end. But before we got to that, I thought I should ask some larger poetry questions. So I first wanted to ask about the influence of place and travel in both of your poems. And I'm going to ask you first. The poems in your first book arise from the landscape of China, where you were living for a year. The poems catalog a person who left a country for this country where I don't make decisions about what I see. You also write in the book, nothing strikes me as incredibly foreign. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the experience of living in a foreign country and China specifically, and how that influenced your first book. Both, I guess, I'm wondering if it influenced sort of the images themselves or the language of, you know, not being able to speak fluently.
Well, I think I definitely took that seriously, trying not to make decisions about what I saw. I just didn't want, I was intentionally trying not to be a judgy American when I went and tried to be more culturally relativist. So I think instead what that did is just sort of disorient me completely. Like I wasn't making judge. I ended up sort of feeling like I was looking at everything, even my own culture, from a distance perspective. And it exposed so much of what I thought about how, like, everything suddenly seemed very strange. Even American television, which I love, seemed so crazy. Like, everything just seemed crazy because I was just disorienting myself and distancing myself from associating with things. So I tried not to write a book about China, but just that experience of seeing myself through and seeing my own culture through a new lens. And the biggest thing was not being around English and how messed up my English became and how it became this idiolect and this private language that I also shared with my now husband, where we would forget like basic word. We forgot the word for piano for like a week, and then I kept calling the TV the piano. It was just, it does crazy things to your English to be that immersed in a language that you're learning. I think if I'd gone there knowing more Chinese, it would have been different.
And were you Were you taking notes on these things, or were you thinking of them as poem, like, oh, I'm writing a poem of how strange this is, or was it just accumulation of notes?
Every day, or but most of the time I just wrote notes, and then I didn't write the poems until I got back.
Okay.
And then I'd work, they were all chronological. At first, all the poems were chronological, and then I realized that, you know, I had to reorder them after that.
The poems in the book were?
Yeah.
Okay. And I'm going to segue to Timothy's question about travel, which is a little bit different. And when I mentioned it to him, he said it was sort of like time travel, which I thought was pretty funny. Because I think you even said something about talking to the dead. And the poems in the new book, the reader does encounter a lot of the ancient world, from Attila the Hun in that poem you read to several titles with the Egyptian Book of the Dead. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how these poems reach back into ancient history, myth, civilization.
Okay. I think I'd be happy to. I do. In my new work, I do have a number of poems that draw from ancient civilization, that borrow from the Book of the Egyptian Book of the Dead. Don't really delve into the Egyptian Book of the Dead and try to sort of treat that material per se, but do lift a number of the titles. The idea of there being a guidebook that will get you into a happy afterlife, I think I took some kind of consolation from that idea. And when I wrote the first of the poems that uses a title from the Egyptian Book of the Dead, it was an elegy for someone who had died. And I'd been looking at the Egyptian Book of the Dead, and there was a particular title that I thought was quite beautiful, and it was Chapter for Being Transformed into, it was a different kind of bird. I turned it into a sparrow, but I think it was Chapter for Being Transformed into a Swallow, but it could have been something else, and I didn't really want Swallow because that comes with the other idea. And I like sparrows because they're very humble, and they're ubiquitous, and I just somehow, I have great sympathy for them and their stern little eyes and how they hop around kind of like little dirty birds. And there was an experience I had at one point when I lived up on 106th Street and up closer to Columbia, 106th and what was that? Near Columbus. What is that street? Manhattan. I'll go through with this. I was in a laundromat, and when I went back, I was visiting a laundromat, using it. When I went back to pick up my laundry from the dryer, there was a sparrow that had been trapped in the laundromat, and all of the people who were doing the laundry were kind of flipping out because the sparrow was spastic and scared. And without thinking, I took a pillowcase from the laundry that I was drying, and I walked up to it and I covered it with the pillowcase, and I walked out to the street with it, and I took the pillowcase off, and the sparrow, rather than just flying away from my sleeve, stopped and turned around and looked at me, and then it flew away. And in a weird way, I just had a certainty that that was my grandmother. And I know that sounds crazy, but what I know that I did was I felt that there was sort of a little tenderness and a gratitude shown to me from this thing that had nothing to do with me, and that I had no conscious design on sort of chaperoning out from this trapped place of the laundromat to the liberty of the sky. But something in the look made me think that here's a sign, here's something for me to latch on to sort of make me feel that the presence of someone that I loved and who had died was still with me. And after looking at me, it flew off. And then I came up with that title for that poem, and through my own sort of unending sense that the dead do stay with us, I was able to look through, page through the Egyptian Book of the Dead and find certain titles that meant more to me than others. And provoked my imagination. And then I started writing a number of poems that did take their titles, like Chapter 4, for removing foolish speech from the mouth, or Chapter 4, Not Dying Again, or Chapter for Breathing Air Among the Waters, all of these really resonant and rich titles. And I started at different times writing poems that took advantage of that richness. And then because of things like the war, I started thinking about Mesopotamia. I started thinking about Atlantis, in part because one of the first people to write extensively on Atlantis was a guy named Ignatius Donnelly. But I also like the idea of this country that sort of got in over its head. That sounds like a pun I hadn't meant it to be, with the water and all. And then it all just started to sort of barrel out. I've always been interested in ancient history, always been interested in archaeology. At one point, I thought that was my inevitable vocation, but it turned out not to be. And I think that, you know, going to the Brooklyn Museum of Art or going to the Met, you sort of can lose yourself in this spooky sense that whatever it is that we're doing here as humans, we've been doing for a very long time. And to a certain degree, we haven't changed, and we seem not to have learned all that much. And when I look at our culture and I compare it to the ones that are no longer with us, I think, you know, as we all probably do, is that the direction we're heading in too? Will someday there be a museum that has laptops in it and media cabinets and pianos? You know? And I just felt sort of the presence of all of that around me. And I think that as a writer, I've always drawn from the recent and the far, in the distant past, both through the literatures of them, you know. And I do have other poems that draw more from particularly contemporary and more recent stuff. I'm not sure if that's a good answer.
That's perfect.
Thanks.
And I think from hearing both of them talk, you can tell they both have these very active imaginations, which are really helpful to being a poet. But rereading both of your works in preparation for this, I came across your line, which you read tonight, which was, I have wanted to be unmoved by the world. And in your new manuscript, you maybe take that sentiment a little bit further and you say, the world tries hard to bore me to death, but not hard enough. No. And so I guess my question now is, what do you find moving or what do you find boring about the world? And I know that's a very big question, so you could feel free to talk about it as an editor, what poems bore you or what bores you on television, what outfits bore you when you see them on the street.
Laundry and cleaning the kitchen. No, but really, that I feel like mainly the things, like I feel like with editing also, there's this percentage that's maintenance of your life and of publishing, and I wish that the world were organized, and life was organized in a way where you didn't have, things were magically clean. But I feel like there are poets who find meaning in stuff like laundry. And I wish I did. But I feel like moved by.
Or why would you want to be unmoved?
Oh, I think there was, I just was at that, when I wrote that, I was feeling too much, which I guess stems more from a personal life than art.
You know, when you ask what bores you and what moves you, I felt like saying everything and everything. I mean, there are times when the same thing can both bore and excite me greatly. There are times when what I want to feel is nothing more than numb completely, and there are times when I feel so numb I wish something, anything, would wake me up. You know, I mean, maybe it's because I'm a Gemini, but I go back and forth between those two positions quite regularly, not without any control over them or resources to sort of stabilize myself. I think this, you know, routine terrifies me, and yet I know that it's necessary. Change terrifies me, but I'm sure that it's the right idea. These are vague answers, right? But I don't know. Usually I feel that I'm being moved too much by stuff. But when I write, the world tries hard to bore me to death, but not hard enough. That is the beginning of that elegy I was talking about. I'm being a little sarcastic there. I think of it as a form of morbid slapstick, because if it were to move me, I mean, bore me to death enough, I would no longer be.
Do you always find yourself writing against boredom, or write like something moves you and you sit down to write it, or is that just not something that? I mean, clearly,
yeah,
that story that you told was something.
I think I usually, that's a good question. It's smart. I think I usually write against an overabundant excitability, and I've got too much going on, and because I usually write some poems with a great deal of kind of formal control to them, that it's controlling the overabundance of spastic things happening in my mind or in my life at any given time, that I hope for the promise of some sense of control over them. Is that, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Jenny.
I don't know if that's wrong.
I
think
you take what you can get.
Yeah. I feel like I'm writing, when I'm trying to write, it's like I'm trying to notice more. It's the opposite, I guess. To have things become more tactile, even language, to see more.
I was also hoping that you both might talk about non-poet writers that have been influenced your work, or that consciously, you know, or unconsciously you've noticed that have seeped into your poems. I know you have a lot of notes, but that seems to come a little bit more from procedural things.
When I was maybe in my early 20s, I went through a phase of reading a lot of Gothic novels, mostly ones from the late 18th century and early 19th century. And there's a certain kind of poised excitability to that language that I identify as being my own vernacular. And I really liked, I read a great deal of those, like The Monk by Matthew Lewis, or The Mysteries of Udolpho, or The Romance of the Forest by Anne Radcliffe, or another, Charles Maturin, The Melmoth the Wanderer. These novels were hugely important to me, as would be, say, Moby Dick, or most of what Nathaniel Hawthorne wrote. He's, I think, extraordinary. And more recently, Beckett, parts of the Ulysses, unsurprising, I suppose. I mean, who isn't gobsmacked by that? Virginia Woolf. And my more, and my less sort of ironic passages, you know, there's a certain intensity and excitability in her work that I respond to pretty strongly. Faulkner, gosh, you know. I'll think of more.
You can talk about Western novels.
Louis the Moor, no. I would say it's the I studied applied linguistics it took me a long time to get my master's, like 5 years I was doing it part-time. And I feel like that stuff is so ingrained in how I think about how I feel towards language even. How language works. And I studied discourse analysis, where we type up conversations, and there were ways to note how long people were going shh, or like how long a pause was, or how stressed a word was. It wasn't related at all to scansion. And it affected not only how I think about how language sounds, but how meaning is made on an everyday level. And it definitely affects how I like my relationship to language in general.
Are you thinking about that more now as a parent?
Yes.
You are?
Yeah.
I guess that's another question, is has parenthood affected how you're writing or how you think about the world? Or do you feel like you're writing different types of poems, or do you see the world differently now because you're both parents?
I want to add to that list, if I may, of prose writers who have been influential to me. I think that maybe like the last third of the poems that I wrote, maybe the last quarter, were in some ways, I found David Foster Wallace's essays extremely extremely good company while writing them. There's a certain energy to his ethos, to his worldview, and to his language, and to his sentences that I felt very much at home in, and that was important to me. As for having children, has that changed my writing? Maybe it's made me feel like time's running out a little bit. And maybe it's made me feel a little bit more protective of life, and a little bit more able to see things as the beauty of things as being sad, but I think that's always been the case. I know maybe I should say happy. I am happier, but I'm more, maybe, the way it is for me, when I open the door that's going to let all the happiness come in, it tends to let in a lot of the other stuff too. And I feel that I'm figuring out how to remain sensitive to the world around me without letting it drag me under too much for the sake of my family and for my writing.
I mean, I might say that the new poems seem a little bit more angry at the world, not at the world, at the war or at pollution or at the sort of large failures of the world. And I'm wondering if there's any correlation, or if that's just...
There may be a correlation. I think I've always been a little bit angry at that, but every poem... I'm angry at pollution. I am, though. It does sound funny. But I think, you know what the truth is, that maybe you'll agree, Jenny, I think that every poem we write brings us a little bit closer to figuring out how to write the poem that we really need someday to write. And of course, this is like an asymptote or something like that. Like, there's this dream of this ideal statement that I can somehow convey through a poem, an ideal expression of whatever it is I feel that means to be alive, that somehow I'll be able to communicate. And of course, it won't be through one particular poem, but it will be through all the steps and the aggregate of what it is that I have done. And I feel that every poem I've written has taught me something new about how to articulate what it means to be here, and to be happy and radically unhappy about that fact simultaneously. I should say radically happy and radically unhappy, because I'm kind of loading the deck a little bit there. There's a lot to be unhappy about, but I'm also, this plate is beautiful.
It
you know
is.
What I mean?
I'm not
insensitive to that. You know?
I mean, I would say in your new poems that there's sort of a direct relationship of making sense of motherhood, at least in the ones I've seen. Having this new baby and communicating and language acquisition, which is right around the corner.
Yeah. I mean, I don't see the same asymptote, maybe because I feel like myself, I have changed so radically, and I don't know if as a feminist I'm allowed to say this, but I feel like I'm not the same person anymore now that I've had a kid. And I think it's like being in China times a million. Like, I'm in this country where I speak totally differently, and there's so much silence, or there's crying, and everything's brand new, and you have to learn everything from scratch. And I think before, I thought of fragmentation as conceptual and as a tool, and now it's like the only thing, basically. Like, I was having a conversation with a friend who just had a baby, and she apologized. She's like, "I'm sorry I'm jumping all over the place." I was like, "I didn't notice." And, you know, it's not that my kid was even there. I just didn't notice anymore, you know. And I hope that this is a form of expansion in terms of what I can conceive of and do. But it feels like there was this very dramatic week after my baby was born where I was like, the old Jenny is dead. I will never go running in the park and just be listening to music and not thinking about this person or not have him in me somewhere, like still as part of my body or in my mind.
Did you feel alienated from the poems you had written before then, that old Jenny?
No, I was like, I wonder if, like, I felt respectful of her. a little bit, yeah, but I feel like not in a bad way. But, yeah.
See, I feel that not only am I the same person, give or take a habit or two or attempts at moderation, I feel also that my daughter is that same person as well. And you, who knows her, yes, will probably testify to that. She's just, it's in the DNA, whatever it is that I have, do, am.
Does anyone have any questions before I get to the James Lipton section of this interview? Okay. Rapid fire, guys. What is your favorite word?
It's a tie, and it's always been this. And there's nothing particularly like exciting about these words. I love the word thorough, and I love the word through. And I realize they're close.
I feel like I need to go home and immediately change all my passwords.
Oh.
But I do. Urchin, I really like the word urchin. Like, I like sea urchins, and I like street urchins, like the idea of them. And I like how it sounds. And I had to take a lot of biology in college, because we all had to, and we did these like crazy experiments on sea urchins, and they're so great. They're beautiful and interesting. And I feel like in New York, a lot of things are like urchins, like water towers, like things just sort of cling onto other things architecturally. So I feel like I see them all over.
Wow. Least favorite word.
Oh, what's your favorite word in Chinese?
It's be careful, which is xiaoxin, which means little heart, which I think is just really sweet.
Yeah.
Sweet. So be careful.
In French, I love pamplemousse, which is grapefruit. I mean, I just think that's the greatest word, pamplemousse.
That's from bath products.
Yeah, they probably do, from French-made bath products. Nice. My least favorite? I know this too. It's especially when used as a verb, but always with an S at the end, cops. I find it totally creeps me out. And when it's custard cups, it's just... But when, like, anything you cup, though, too, like the verb cup, he or she cups
like,
the...
What about Chinese cupping?
I don't think I like that. I don't even know what that is,
It's pretty extreme. It's extreme, like you...
Oh, is that when they draw out toxins from the body?
Yeah, and they, like, light a flame over a cup and it sucks your skin like into the cup.
I like the objective. I don't care for the terminology.
Maybe I'm inspired by Timothy's word, but I don't like leftovers. I feel like it's such an obvious word. It's like leftovers. Yeah. Like you couldn't come up with it. I think there are better words for that. And I hate leftovers. Like I don't bring them places that I should to eat. Like work.
What sound or noise do you love?
Oh, really? Oh. like sentimental things, like the way that I have a 10 and a half month old baby, and the way that she's just starting to say, da-da, like really feathery, is a just beautiful thing to me. And the way that the sound of her moving on the floor and squealing when she comes to the door of the room in which I'm writing, and that's very sweet. The kinds of grunts that she makes when I'm eating a bowl of cereal or anything, because she wants some,
I guess I even like that too. I like the sound of Baroque music. I like the sound of rainfall and stuff like that. Oh my God, am I really?
Sorry.
This is terrible. I know it.
Sorry.
Rainfall.
I actually like the sound of whistling, and I think it's because my husband, like,
very
I can.
Very good whistler.
He's a very good whistler, and I know that he's coming home. Like, I can hear whistling, but sometimes I'll be on the street and I'll hear whistling. And I'll get excited. It's like a homeless man, like, whistling in a gross way, and I still like it.
Like catcalling.
Oh, I know a sound that I don't like at all. Is that next?
That is next.
Oh. I don't, I don't like the sound of the new packaging for Sun Chips, which is this wholly biodegradable packaging, which I'm glad
it's
for.
Terrible.
But have you heard the noise? It's a deafening crackle. No, when you hear it, if you haven't already, when you hear it, you'll remember I said this. It's an inconceivably loud. It's just this regular kind of package, like a bag made out of a kind of plastic-like thing, but the noise it makes can be heard from space.
What other profession other than...
Jenny's bad noise.
Oh.
Jenny's bad noise.
There's so many, but... Oh, there's...
Man whistling.
That's
uh-huh.
I think that... Oh, it just because it makes, like, vacuum cleaner. I don't like that. I know some people don't mind it. That sound. Also, the sound right when the stove is about to light. Like, I get a little worried.
Yeah,
the gas,
yeah, that's good. Yeah,
out.
Sure, that's a good one.
Yeah, and there's clicking, and you're like, is it going to happen?
Also, telephone noise.
Just or ringing.
Just ringing. Okay.
Another profession you would like to have?
Chef.
Ichthyologist.
Wow, really? That's quick.
Because whenever I've been unhappy in a job, I've like research graduate programs, and you know, it's because I saw this great movie at the Museum of Natural History on In Search of the Great Fat Catfish, where these ichthyologists find a skeleton of a fat, really fatty fish in the Museum of Natural History, and they go to Colombia to try where these bones are from to try and find it, and they run it into all these people, and they're like, oh yeah, I remember this fish, the stories about this fish. People would light it on fire and use it as a torch. It was so fatty. And they set up all of these nets and stuff to try, and they like keep hearing, oh, they're in this area, and they keep getting all these good tips about where they can find this fat catfish. And they're like, think they're on the verge of finding it. And then they find out that gorillas are going to come and kill them if they don't leave the country immediately, and that's how the movie ends.
Aww.
And I was like, that seems like the best job. And fish are so beautiful. Fish are so beautiful, and you see this little romance between these two ichthyologists kind of forming.
Well, that's
and they
not
don't
part
know
of
it.
The job, though.
That's not a guarantee.
No, it is.
Favorite color? Yours?
Green, kind of like a yellowy green.
I like purple. Not to wear, but
okay.
Yeah, to look at. It's nice.
Thanks.
I love that color so much. Whenever I see it, I think that whatever is that color is mine. Like, I just think that's, yeah. I mean, I know it's not, and I go through a certain sort of debriefing, but I...
What was the first concert you attended?
Oh, brother. You know, like the Thompson Twins or something like that? Or In Excess? Like something terrible. That's an awful question. Joni Mitchell.
Mine was the Ramones.
That's a terrific answer,
yeah.
Though. Oh, that's why you ask it. Yeah. Jenny, what are you?
I think it was Rafi.
I don't even know what that is.
What is that?
Ralphie.
He was a child. I think my dad also took me to Grateful Dead concerts when I was like 12. But
I was wondering if you would each read one more poem and we could close out.
You got other ones there.
I know, but you want me to go on?
Sure.
I have a whole page.
This
favorite
is...
flower.
Foxglove.
I like the dogwood blossoms.
Mm-hmm.
Toucan, yeah. Obviously.
I don't have a favorite bird.
You don't? Favorite fish?
The great fat.
Okay.
That's a bad sound.
Well, the next one's got a little bit, like, how would you like to die?
What?
They ask it. It's on the list.
How would you like to die?
No, that's why I didn't. That's why I was slowing down, going right to the. Okay, we'll end with this. What is your motto?
Are we supposed to have mottos?
Yeah. Like 2009, mine was 2000 fine. Like,
oh.
Like any kind of. What do you say to yourself to get through the day? I mean, there has to be.
It's almost over.
Maybe there's an avocado in the kitchen. Like that.
Is that really the last one?
Well, that's the last one. I have more. What is your present state of mind?
Curious to see what other questions you would ask us. I don't think I should read another poem. I feel as if I've read too long already. Okay. But that's Jenny ought to. I'd like to hear another one from you. But we can ask a couple more questions, maybe. I enjoy. Is this not enjoyable?
No, it's good.
Okay, you asked for it. If heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
I know what
he will
say.
You're asking for it.
I bet he'll say, "You again." I don't know why. That's a curse to me.
I watched this interview too many times to be able to, like.
Are these really taken from?
Yeah.
Ah. Oh.
He asked at the end of every actor's studio. He asked these questions, and they're based on Bernard Pivot's questions, which were made really famous by Proust. Answered them. Vanity Fair.
Oh wow.
In the back of each
okay.
issue. Not the first concert one. I threw that in because I had such a good first concert.
Oh right. My favorite painter, maybe. Yep. Who's your favorite painter?
Musician?
Painter? I don't know. I haven't thought about these things in a long time.
Right now I feel like saying Cy Twombly. I like looking at his paintings. Is that?
Good answer.
Thank you.
Who would you like to see on a new banknote?
On a new banknote?
Lady Gaga?
You, Brett.
That's why I asked that question.
Okay.
Well.
Not the toucan.
Okay, Jenny, another poem.
Okay. I'm going to read a new poem so you can see how fragmented my brain has become. And this is going to be in the new public space. It's called Road. The ice encases the branches of trees as if beauty can just. We are together in this car until the bell of my body rings. There is always the idea of the driving line toward meaning, a school of fish, the target inside the head. You have been a tonic against the thought wasps and a rival in silence and bullseye. I liked arrival as a road as a me. Now I land on ideas, but I can't. The loop of my sounding hits outward keeps pulling up ahead.
Thanks for having us.